DiscerningHearts.com, in cooperation with the Archdiocese of Omaha, presents the United States Catholic Catechism for Adults with His Excellency, Archbishop George Lucas. The United States Catholic Catechism for Adults is an adaptation of the Catholic Catechism. It serves as a resource for those who wish to become acquainted with Catholicism. It is an invitation for all the faithful to continue growing in the understanding of Jesus Christ and His saving love for all people. The United States Catholic Catechism for Adults with His Excellency, Archbishop George Lucas. I'm your host, Chris McGregor.
Chapter 33, The Ninth Commandment, Practice Purity of Heart. Maria Goretti, a Model of Purity. Maria Goretti was born in Corinaldo, Italy, on October 16, 1890. She was one of six children born to Luigi Goretti and Assunta Carlini. In 1896, the family moved to Ferrari di Conca, where the Gorettis became sharecroppers for Count Mazzolini. The Goretti family lived in an old cheese factory building on the estate, where Assunta worked hard to make a home for her family. Due to the hard labor of draining the flooded estate, Luigi soon contracted malaria and was unable to adequately manage the land for which he was responsible. On account of this, Count Mazzolini sent Giovanni Serinelli and his son Alessandro to share half the work, half the profits, and half of the building which the Goretti family had made into a home. The Goretti parents soon became aware that the Serinellis were not people of high moral character. As Luigi's malaria became more severe, Luigi and Assunta regretted their leaving Coronado. The position of the Goretti family took a tragic turn upon Luigi's death in 1902. Since Assunta was now forced to work in the fields to provide for the family, she put Maria in charge of the duties at home. Maria had grown in virtue and grace throughout her childhood. She also had a great devotion to the Blessed Sacrament, which she received for the first time in May of that same year. Alessandro began stalking Maria and making suggestive advances towards her, advances that she always unhesitatingly refused. Ultimately, her refusal sparked him to take matters into his own hands. On July 5, 1902, Maria, who was not yet 12 years old, was peacefully stitching and caring for her little sister, Teresa. Alessandro, who was 18 years old, grabbed Maria's arm, dragged her into the kitchen, and attempted to rape her. She fought him and pleaded with him to stop, exclaiming that what he was attempting was a sin forbidden by God. Her resistance infuriated Alessandro, who, after failing to choke her into submission, stabbed her 14 times. Maria was taken to a hospital, where she suffered for an entire day. Upon gaining consciousness, she fixed her gaze on a statue of the Blessed Mother that was at the foot of her bed. Before receiving viaticum, she forgave Alessandro for what he had done and expressed the desire that he might join her in heaven. She died of her wounds on July 6, 1902. Alessandro Serinelli was soon apprehended, convicted, and sentenced to 30 years in prison for his crime. 8 years into his sentence, Maria appeared to him in a dream. In that dream, Maria gathered lilies, which she then handed to him. The lilies took on radiance that assured him of her forgiveness. This vision led to a conversion, which brought him into reconciliation with God, the church, and the Goretti family. Pope Pius XII canonized Maria Goretti on June 24, 1950. Her mother Assunta and her murderer Alessandro Serinelli were both present. Saint Maria Goretti has been named the patroness of modern youth. Her love for her attacker shone in her forgiveness of him, and her spiritual and physical purity of heart serve as a model for all Christians. Her purity exemplifies the ninth commandment.
Welcome, Your Excellency.
Thank you, Chris.
The ninth commandment, practice purity of heart, it really has its basis, again, on that ninth commandment, which is rooted in lust, isn't it? That terrible capital sin.
Right. The commandment is reminding us to not be ruled by lust or to give in to lust. The traditional way of saying it, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife. It's related, of course, to the sixth commandment. And it's probably worth noting in this time when the whole understanding of marriage is being questioned in popular culture, and when there are these attempts to redefine marriage, that there have been threats to the nature of marriage and the good of marriage from the very beginning and from the time of Moses, as we see in the commandments. God holds up for us the good of married love and of a chaste way of approaching human sexuality. These can't be divided quite so strictly, but the sixth commandment seems to deal with conduct. The ninth commandment calls us to a moral way of thinking and judging things, as the one section here talks about a morality of the heart. So as Jesus reminds us in the Sermon on the Mount, so many evil actions begin in the human heart with an evil or a disordered desire, which we begin to entertain and then bears fruit often in evil actions. Even if it doesn't do that, it's corrupting us if we hang on to an evil desire.
It is something that has been in that human heart since recorded time. You hear all the stories of that type of lust or jealousy, envy, all those types of things when looking at another person. It seems even more challenging in today's world because there seem to have been areas which, well, how can I say this? We're just not living in a Jane Austen world anymore, where the type of behavior of others tends to discourage or to not encourage that demeanor.
We're living with all the effects and the fruits of the sexual revolution, and that revolution has told us very directly and very strongly just the opposite of this commandment, that it's okay to covet my neighbor's wife, that it's okay to covet anybody, and it's okay for anybody to covet me. So to articulate this commandment these days, it's kind of seems so foreign to what we just breathe in the air around us and pick up off the ground. So all the more important for us to study the commandment and to receive it really as divine wisdom. It's a reminder right away. You know, we know that an effect of original sin is that our desires have become disordered. So we have desires and appetites that are part of human nature, and that's part of the way that God has put us together. But because of original sin and of our own sinfulness, those things can become disordered. So just the way the commandment is stated, you know, for right-thinking people, it's obvious that I shouldn't nurture in my heart a desire for someone else's wife. If I begin to sense that desire, I should recognize right away that that's disordered. I can't pursue that. It's not right for me. And so there's a way in virtue to deal with that, so that I get my mind and my heart turned around right. But that's really what the commandment highlights, that we experience in any number of ways a desire for people or things that are they're disordered because they're not appropriate for me and to pursue, either because of my vocation, because of the vocation of another person, because of another's innate human dignity, for any number of reasons. And part of our challenge in the light of the gospel is to sort those things out.
Mm-hmm. It's one thing when it we can clearly see blatantly, in maybe even in our own hearts, a desire for another, if they are indeed our neighbor, I mean next door neighbor, or somebody that we might work with, that's very clear. Are we committing the sin, Your Excellency, if we look at the television and there is somebody on there that we desire, though we know we never would have the opportunity, yet the desire is there, or we see it in a magazine or in some other medium?
We see all kinds of things around us, people and things, and again, in the kind of sex-saturated culture and the media, certainly. So we try to practice prudence in terms of where we go and what we look at. But, you know, we're not responsible for things or people that may come into our vision or come onto our mental screen, we might say. And so we begin to notice a desire or an attraction, and that's just noticing. But noticing, then, we begin to take a responsibility. This commandment reminds us of that, to put that in its proper place. And so to be able to judge for myself whether this is something that I can continue to encourage, to follow up on morally, or if this is what we might call a moral dead end for me. And in many cases, it is. Again, the virtue of chastity leads us to think that many of the things that seem attractive to us, people that seem attractive to us, those are not relationships or situations that we can pursue. And so we have a responsibility then to not pursue them and to look in another direction, at least figuratively, you know, to not entertain thoughts, encourage desires that simply are not morally wholesome for us.
That, can we say the training of the heart actually can begin at a very young age? I mean, with the conduct that our children see.
The training of the heart and what we used to call the custody of the eyes, you know, to be careful, really, the kind of images that we allow in through our eyes and ears, because those things get in our minds and they get in our hearts, and they're not always wholesome. Some things are very neutral in themselves, you know, and because our desires, our understandings are disordered, we can twist them. But these days, there's an awful lot that assaults our minds, our senses. To the extent that we begin to develop a mature understanding of what are those things that affect us, then we need to sort of police ourselves, you might say, and our use of the media, but also our conversation, the company we keep. This commandment really encourages us to look at all of that and to admit that if I'm going to be a person who grows in virtue, then there's some situations, some places, some relationships that are not appropriate for me. Not now, they're probably never going to be. So fill my life with other things that are wholesome, that encourage virtue.
A meditation from the United States Catholic Catechism for Adults. At the conclusion of the Jubilee year 2000, Pope John Paul II reflected on his meetings with young people throughout that year. And how could we fail to recall especially the joyful and inspiring gathering of young people? If there is an image of the Jubilee of the year 2000 that more than any other will live on in memory, it is surely the streams of young people with whom I was able to engage in a sort of very special dialogue, filled with mutual affection and deep understanding. It was like this from the moment I welcomed them in the square of St. John Lateran and St. Peter's Square. Then I saw them swarming through the city, happy as young people should be, but also thoughtful, eager to pray, seeking meaning, and true friendship. Neither for them nor for those who saw them will it be easy to forget that week, during which Rome became young with the young. Yet again, the young have shown themselves to be for Rome and for the Church a special gift of the Spirit of God. Sometimes, when we look at the young with problems and weaknesses that characterize them in contemporary society, we tend to be pessimistic. The Jubilee of the Young People, however, changed that, telling us that young people, whatever their possible ambiguities, have a profound longing for those genuine values which find their fullness in Christ. Is not Christ the secret of true freedom and profound joy of heart? Is not Christ the supreme friend and the teacher of all genuine friendship? If Christ is presented to young people as he really is, they experience him as an answer that is convincing, and they can accept his message, even when it is demanding and bears the mark of the cross. For this reason, in response to their enthusiasm, I did not hesitate to ask them to make a radical choice of faith and life and present them with a stupendous task: to become morning watchmen at the dawn of the new millennium. Yeah, it's a sad commentary, I think, in some ways, that we, going back to that training of the heart of our children, that we will establish laws where kids cannot drink until they're 21. They can't smoke cigarettes till they're 16. And yet there are forms of contraception that we feel they cannot control themselves, so they should be available to them at an age even in junior high, that somehow there is something that can't be controlled, so they give in to it.
Here again, it's the doctrine, so-called, of the sexual revolution. And the sexual revolution wasn't in full force at the time that Moses published the Ninth Commandment, but it certainly does apply as much today as it ever did. That so-called doctrine lead us to think that sexual activity, sexual pursuit should be available to anyone at any time, as long as we're not hurting ourselves or anyone else, whatever that means, you know. And we know very well that a lack of self-control with regard to sexuality and many other categories, too, that it can be very harmful to us, to individuals, on a very human level, psychologically, physically, in all kinds of ways. So it's important that we sort of recognize what the false doctrines that modern culture presents to us, critique them, you know, and we have to live in the world we're living in. This is where God put us. But to be able to understand what's healthy, what's wholesome, also what's dangerous for us spiritually, and particularly dangerous for young people. It's one thing for a mature adult to be assaulted by images that are salacious or that are would tempt one to lust. For a young person, they don't have the perspective, the categories to put all that in, and so it's very easy to develop habits of the mind and heart that are very unhealthy with regard to human sexuality, to a respect for self and for respectful relationships with others. Adults, parents, teachers, others, all of us, though, really have a responsibility to the younger people among us to act in a way that's respectful and modest ourselves, and then to help them understand how to critique the world in which we live so that they can live in it, but also live in it in a way that enables them to grow closer to Christ, and then to be witnesses of what's really good and true to their neighbors as they get older.
That's one thing for us on the interior to check ourselves. It's another thing in what we may be presenting out in the world that could potentially lead another into a danger territory as far as their what will motivate their hearts. Our states of dress in a very real way in the United States sometimes is shocking, even when someone may go to church on a Sunday and not realize that the lack of apparel is making quite a statement. And what's really sad is that in most cases, they really don't realize it. They don't realize the message they're sending.
Modesty is a virtue, and it's one that is perhaps not so popular or widely known these days, and maybe thought by some as old-fashioned. But you're right, though, that in the way that we speak, in the way that we dress, in the places that we invite other people to go to with us, or that we talk about being involved in ourselves, all of those things send some kind of a message. we need to be responsible for adopting the virtue of modesty ourselves and practicing it and trying to act in a way that's modest. Again, we don't have to be old fogies about this, and styles change, and there can be different sensibilities in different ages. There should be no mistaking, you know, that our modern culture, again, as a result of the sexual revolution, which continues to go on, really encourages us to think that modesty is not important, and that the culture often trivializes human sexuality and sees the notion of lust as, you know, kind of inconsequential, until somebody's offended or somebody's really hurt, and then all kind of cry breaks out better in the practice of virtue to, you know, to avoid the occasion of sin, to avoid leading others to sin, at the same time build up a true respect for the gift of human sexuality and build up a respect for the dignity of the people around us whom we relate to in various ways, but always chastely.
In this chapter as well, it brings up a term I don't think we've addressed yet, but it's an important one when we talk about disorders of not only the heart, but of mind, soul, and that's concupiscence. Could you help us to understand how that can affect us?
Concupiscence is just really wanting something that's not good for me. And, you know, it could be said better than that, but that's it in a nutshell. Another way of saying it is by wanting things that are against God's law, because God's desire for us is only for what's good for us. And so to the extent that we desire to have something or to do something that God has forbidden or that God's law forbids, what we're really saying is that it's not good or life-giving for us. Otherwise, God would want it for us already. We suffer from concupiscence as a result of original sin. And again, the conditioning that we've done of ourselves, of our own sinful habits or decisions. So that these very natural human desires that we experience without looking for them, and nobody has to teach them to us particularly, that they can often be for something that's very good. So the desire to eat every day is a good thing. It's necessary for us to live. It can become disordered if we're eating all the time to the detriment of our health, or if we're eating things that are harmful or poisonous, or, I mean, there's all kinds of ways for a desire or an inclination to become disordered. And we see that in the area of human sexuality as well. So the commandment points out one thing very clearly: to really actively desire some person who's married to someone else. That's a disordered desire. That other person is not free to marry. For a person who's married himself or herself, someone who's a priest, someone whose life is already settled and committed in a vocation in a public way, to actively desire or pursue a relationship with another person is immoral, because I'm not free myself to pursue that. So we would call that desire disordered. It's not the same thing as a simple superficial attraction, recognizing that someone is attractive to us, and that there's nothing sinful in that, but to cultivate from that attraction a desire in a direction that my life cannot take according to, you know, God's plan for me, my own commitments, then we call that desire disordered. And that's, again, it's the result of original sin, as we experience it all the time. That's why redemption is necessary, because we sometimes, because our self-control is also affected by sin, we give in to disordered desires, inclinations. And so we need God's forgiveness, and we need the healing that comes through the Paschal mystery of Jesus Christ. We need to be redeemed from this part of us that's broken or bent.
Any final thoughts on this particular chapter?
We need to, I think, remind ourselves that we're being assaulted all the time in regard to modesty. Advertising in particular is just so crass in presenting human sexuality as a way to tantalize us into looking at particular products or services. We often look at ads and think, well, you know, what's really being advertised here? What's really being sold? Because we're surrounded by so much of that, our sensibilities can be dulled. And again, perhaps some of us get to an age or a level of maturity where we don't pay much attention to it. But we really need to be aware of the effect that it has on young people. In our families, the ones that we're particularly responsible for. But here again, we all have a responsibility for the common good and for creating an atmosphere, a culture in which young people can grow to understand the dignity of the human person, their own dignity to not see themselves or others as simply objects of desire.
Yeah, I would suppose this is a flip to this where someone may be lusting after another. It's also a sin, isn't it, to desire to be lusted after. Hence, you know, especially in this culture, I mean, we see it so often, we will almost, speaking as a female, of course, make ourselves up in such a way with makeup and clothing and everything that the goal is, in many ways, not just to look nice, but to be lusted after.
Yeah, both men and women are capable of doing that, of course. And would be another way that where we would be violating the ninth commandment in terms of really sort of objectifying ourselves and putting ourselves in front of others as simply an object of desire, an object of pleasure, and that too is wrong. It's demeans ourselves. It encourages other people to fall into desires or patterns of behavior that are not respectful for them either.
Mm. Well, thank you so much, Your Excellency.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the United States Catholic Catechism for Adults with His Excellency, Archbishop George Lucas. To learn more about the United States Catholic Catechism for Adults, go to usccb.org, the website for the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, or you can find it at any fine Catholic bookstore. To hear and or download this episode, along with many others, go to discerninghearts.com. This has been a production of discerninghearts.com in cooperation with the Archdiocese of Omaha. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join me next time for the United States Catholic Catechism for Adults with His Excellency, Archbishop George Lucas.